堂听 class.com。
四、小说抄诵，升级英语妙方。抄诵经典名著，感动一生。
Hearts and Hands。
铁腕柔情。
At Denver, a great many passengers joined the coaches on the eastbound Boston and Main train. In one coach, there sat a very pretty young woman. She was beautifully and richly dressed. Among the newcomers were two men. The younger one was good-looking with a bold, honest face and manner. The other was a large, sad-faced person, roughly dressed. The two were handcuffed together.As they passed down the aisle of the coach, the only empty seat was one facing the young woman. Here, the linked pair seated themselves. The woman quickly glanced at them with disinterest. Then, with a lovely smile, she held out a little gray-gloved hand. When she spoke, her voice showed that she was used to speaking and being heard.Well, Mr. Easton, if you will make me speak first, I suppose I must. Don't you ever say hello to old friends when you meet them in the West? The younger man pulled himself up sharply at the sound of her voice. He seemed to struggle with a little embarrassment, which he threw off instantly. Then he held her fingers with his left hand. It's Miss Fairchild, he said with a smile.I ask you to excuse the other hand. I'm not able to use it just at present. He slightly raised his right hand, which was bound at the wrist by the shining bracelet, to the left one of his partner. The happy look in the woman's eyes slowly changed to one of puzzled horror. The glow passed from her cheek. Easton, with a little laugh as if amused,was about to speak again when the other stopped him. The sad-faced man had been watching the young woman's face with his sharp, searching eyes. You'll excuse me for speaking, miss, but I see you know the marshal here. If you'll ask him to speak a word for me when we get to the prison, he'll do it. It'll make things easier for me there. He's taking me to Leavenworth Prison. It's 7 years for counterfeiting.Oh, she said with a deep breath and returning color. So that is what you were doing out here, a marshal. My dear Miss Fairchild, said Easton calmly, I had to do something. Money has a way of taking wings. You know, it takes money to keep in step with our crowd in Washington. I saw this opening in the West and, well...A marshal isn't quite as high a position as that of an ambassador, but... The ambassador, she said warmly, doesn't call anymore. He needn't ever have done so. You ought to know that. So now you are one of these dashing Western heroes, and you ride and shoot and go into all kinds of dangers. That's different from the Washington life. You have been missed by the old crowd. The woman's eyes, interested, went back, widening a little to rest upon the shiny handcuffs. Don't you worry about them, miss, said the other man. All marshals handcuff themselves to their prisoners to keep them from getting away. Mr. Easton knows his business. Will we see you again in Washington? Asked Miss Fairchild.Not soon, I think, said Easton. My carefree days are over, I fear. I love the West, she said. Her eyes were shining softly. She looked away, and out the train window she began to speak truly and simply, forgetting about style and manner. Mama and I spent the summer in Denver. She went home a week ago because Father was ill.I could live and be happy in the West. I think the air here agrees with me. Money isn't everything, but people always misunderstand things and remain stupid. Say, Mr. Marshall, growled the sad-faced man, this isn't quite fair. I'm needing a drink of water. Have you been talking long enough? Take me into the dining car now, won't you? The bound travelers rose to their feet. Easton still had the same slow smile on his face. I can't say no to a need for water, he said lightly. It's the one friend of the unfortunate. Goodbye, Miss Fairchild. Duty calls, you know. He held out his hand for a farewell. It's too bad you are not going east, she said, remembering again her manner and style. But you must go to Leavenworth, I suppose. Yes, said Easton, I must go on to Leavenworth. The two men made their way down the aisle into the dining car. The two passengers in a seat nearby heard most of the conversation, said one of them. That Marshall is a good sort of a chap. Some of these Westerners are all right. Pretty young to hold an office like that, isn't he? Asked the other. Young, exclaimed the first speaker. Why? Oh, didn't you catch on? Say, did you ever know an officer to handcuff a prisoner to his right hand? The richer, the poorer.
贫富之间.
Over the years, Lottie had urged Bess to prepare for her old age. Over the years, Bess had lived each day as if there were no other. Now they were both past 60, the time for summing up. Lottie had a bank account that had never grown lean. Bess had the clothes on her back and the rest of her worldly possessions in a battered suitcase. Lottie had hated being a child. Hearing her parents skimping and scraping, Bess had never seemed to notice. All she ever wanted was to go outside and play. She learned to skate on borrowed skates. She rode a borrowed bicycle. Lottie couldn't wait to grow up and buy herself the best of everything. As soon as anyone would hire her, Lottie put herself to work. She minded babies. She ran errands for the old. She never touched a penny of her money, though her child's mouth watered for ice cream and candy. But she could not bear to share with Bess, who never had anything to share with her. When the dimes began to add up to dollars, she lost her taste for sweets. By the time she was 12, she was clerking after school in a small variety store. Saturdays she worked as long as she was wanted. She decided to keep her money for clothes. When she entered high school, she would wear a wardrobe that neither she nor anyone else would be able to match. But her freshman year found her unable to indulge so frivolous a whim, particularly when her admiring instructors advised her to think seriously for college. No one in her family had ever gone to college, and certainly Bess would never get there. She would show them all what she could do if she put her mind to it. She began to bank her money, and her handbook became her most private and precious possession. In her third year of high school, she found a job in a small but expanding restaurant where she cashiered from the busy hour until closing. In her last year of high school, the business increased so rapidly that Lottie was faced with the choice of staying in school or working full-time. She made her choice easily. A job in hand was worth two in the future. Bess had a beau in the school band who had no other ambition except to play a horn. Lottie expected to be settled with a home and family while Bess was still waiting for Harry to earn enough to buy a marriage license. That Bess married Harry straight out of high school was not surprising. That Lottie never married at all was not really surprising either. Two or three times she was halfway persuaded, but to give up a job that paid well for a homemaking job that paid nothing was a risk she was incapable of taking. Bess's married life was nothing for Lottie to envy. She and Harry lived like gypsies. Harry, playing in second-rate bands all over the country, even getting himself and Bess stranded in Europe. They were of 10 in rags and never in riches. Bess grieved because she had no child, not having sense enough to know she was better off without one. Lottie was certainly better off without nieces and nephews to feel sorry for. Very likely, Bess would have dumped them on her doorstep. That Lottie had a doorstep they might have been left on was only because her boss, having bought a second house, offered Lottie his first house at a price so low and terms so reasonable that it would have been like losing money to refuse. She shut off the rooms she didn't use, letting them go to rack and ruin. Since she ate her meals out, she had no food at home and did not encourage callers who always expected a cup of tea. Her way of life was mean and miserly, but she did not know it. She thought she lived frugally in her middle years so that she could live in comfort and ease when she most needed peace of mind. The years after 40 began to race. Suddenly, Lottie was 60 and retired from her job by her boss's son, who had no sentimental feeling about keeping her on until she was ready to quit. She made several attempts to find other employment, but her dowdy appearance made her look old and inefficient. For the first time in her life, Lottie would gladly have worked for nothing to have some place to go, something to do with her day. Harry died abroad in a third-rate hotel with Bess weeping as hard as if he had left her a fortune. He had left her nothing but his horn. There wasn't even enough money for her passage home. Lottie, trapped by the blood tie, knew she would not only have to send for her sister, but take her in when she returned. It didn't seem fair that Bess should reap the harvest of Lottie's lifetime of self-denial. It took Lottie a week to get a bedroom ready, a week of hard work and hard cash. There was everything to do, everything to replace or paint. When she was through, the room looked so fresh and new that Lottie felt she deserved it more than Bess. She would let Bess have her room, but the mattress was so lumpy, carpet so worn, the curtains so threadbare that Lottie's conscience pricked her. She supposed she would have to redo that room, too, and went about doing it with an eagerness that she mistook for haste. When she was through upstairs, she was shocked to see how dismal downstairs looked by comparison. She tried to ignore it, but now nowhere to go to escape it, the contrast grew more intolerable. She worked her way from the kitchen to parlor, persuading herself she was only putting the rooms to rights to give herself something to do. At night, she slept like a child after a long and happy day of playing house. She was having more fun than she had ever had in her life. She was living each hour for itself. There was only a day now before Bess would arrive. Passing her gleaming mirrors at first with vague awareness, then with painful clarity, Lottie saw herself as others saw her, and could not stand the sight. She went on a spending spree from the specialty shops to the beauty salon, emerging transformed into a woman who believed in miracles. She was in the kitchen basting a turkey when Bess rang the bell. Her heart raced and she wondered if the heat from the oven was responsible. She went to the door and Bess stood before her. Stiffly, she suffered Bess's embrace, her heart racing harder, her eyes suddenly smarting from the onrush of cold air. "Oh, Lottie, it's good to see you," Bess said, but saying nothing about Lottie's splendid appearance. Upstairs, Bess, putting down her shabby suitcase, said, "I'll sleep like a rock tonight," without a word of praise for her lovely room. At the lavish table, top heavy with turkey, Bess said, "I'll take light and dark both," with no marveling at the size of the bird, or that there was turkey for two elderly women, one of them too poor to buy her own bread. With the glow of good food in her stomach, Bess began to spin stories. They were rich with places and people, most of them lowly, all of them magnificent. Her face reflected her telling, the joys and sorrows of her remembering, and above all, the love she lived by that enhanced the poorest place, the humblest person. Then it was that Lottie knew why Bess had made no mention of her finery, or the shining room, or the 12-pound turkey. She had not even seen them. Tomorrow, she would see the room as it really looked, and Lottie as she really looked, and the warmed-over turkey in its second-day glory. Tonight, she saw only what she had come seeking, a place in her sister's home and heart. She said, "That's enough about me. How have the years used you?" "It was me who didn't use them," said Lottie wistfully. "I saved for them. I forgot the best of them would go without my ever spending a day or a dollar enjoying them. That's my life story in those few words. A life never lived. Now it's too near the end to try." Bess said, "To know how much there is to know is the beginning of learning to live. Don't count the years that are left us. At our time of life, it's the days that count. You've too much catching up to do to waste a minute of a waking hour feeling sorry for yourself." Lottie grinned, a real wide open grin. "Well, to tell you the truth, I felt sorry for you. Maybe if I had any sense, I'd feel sorry for myself after all. I know I'm too old to kick up my heels, but I'm going to let you show me how. If I land on my head, I guess it won't matter. I feel giddy already, and I like it."
抄送畅销书，捕捉美丽英文。
Rich Dad's Money Making Secrets。
富爸爸谈财商。
The most important thing to becoming rich is, do you have the mindset to want to become rich? When I was 9 years old, my poor dad, the school teacher, said, put the game away. Study, study, study. You're wasting your time playing Monopoly. And my rich dad said the formula. You must open your mind and see the formula right on Monopoly. He said, it's right in front of you. And I went, what's the formula? And finally I learned the formula is 4 greenhouses, red hotel. 4 greenhouses, red hotel. Today I'm a rich man because all I ever did since the time I was 24 years old is buy 4 greenhouses, sell them all, buy red hotel. 4 greenhouses, red hotel. It is not, you do not have to go to school to become rich. Just play Monopoly. 4 greenhouses, red hotel. That is it. You must look at how people before you have become rich. Do not talk to poor people. Poor people will tell you, oh, it's too risky. Don't do that. Don't take risks. Save your money. Play safe. That is a poor person's mindset. You must have open mindset. Open. And if you have an open mindset, you will learn from everything. If you have a closed mindset, you will learn from nothing. So I think that is the most important thing. The middle class and poor, what they want is high income. They think they want money, but they have no wealth because they have no assets. You must know the difference between money and wealth, because they're not the same things. Money will never make you rich. This makes you rich. I have large companies. I have lots of stocks. I trade options. I have real estate. That's what makes me rich. So that money just comes in whether I work or not. Bill Gates only makes $500,000 a year. That's all. I make more than him. That's all he makes. But he's worth $20 billion. I'm trying to tell you there is a very big difference between income, money, and wealth. So I have spent my life buying assets, businesses, stocks, real estate. That's what makes you rich. Not a job. The reason the rich in America get richer is they pass this on to their kids. My poor dad always said, high paying job, high paying job, high paying job. And my rich dad said, assets, assets, assets. That's the difference.
In all this Cuban business, there is one man stands out on the horizon of my memory like Mars at perihelion. When war broke out between Spain and the United States, it was very necessary to communicate quickly with the leader of the insurgents. Garcia was somewhere in the mountain vastness of Cuba. No one knew where. No mail nor telegraph message could reach him. The president must secure his cooperation and quickly. What to do? Someone said to the president, "There's a fellow by the name of Rowan who will find Garcia for you, if anybody can." Rowan was sent for and given a letter to be delivered to Garcia. How the fellow by the name of Rowan took the letter, sealed it up in an oilskin pouch, strapped it over his heart, in 4 days landed by night off the coast of Cuba, from an open boat, disappeared into the jungle, and in 3 weeks came out on the other side of the island, having traversed a hostile country on foot. And delivered his letter to Garcia are things I have no special desire now to tell in detail. The point that I wish to make is this. McKinley gave Rowan a letter to be delivered to Garcia. Rowan took the letter and did not ask where is he at. By the eternal, there is a man whose form should be cast in deathless bronze and the statue placed in every college of the land. It is not book learning young men need, nor instruction about this and that, but a stiffening of the vertebrae, which will cause them to be loyal to a trust, to act promptly, concentrate their energies, do the thing, carry a message to Garcia. General Garcia is dead now, but there are other Garcias. No man has endeavored to carry out an enterprise where many hands were needed, but has been well nigh appalled at times by the imbecility of the average man, the inability or unwillingness to concentrate on a thing and do it. Slipshod assistance, foolish inattention, doughty indifference, and half-hearted work seem the rule. And no man succeeds unless by hook or crook or threat he forces or bribes other men to assist him. Or God in his goodness performs a miracle and sends him an angel of light for an assistant. You, reader, put this matter to a test. You are sitting now in your office. Six clerks are within call. Summon anyone and make this request. Please look in the encyclopedia and make a brief memorandum for me concerning the life of Correggio. Will the clerk quietly say, "Yes, sir," and go do the task? On your life, he will not. He will look at you out of a fishy eye and ask one or more of the following questions. Who was he? Which encyclopedia? Where is the encyclopedia? Was I hired for that? Don't you mean Bismarck? What's the matter with Charlie doing it? Is he dead? Is there any hurry? Shan't bring you the book and let you look it up yourself? What do you want to know for? And I will lay you 10 to 1 that after you have answered the questions and explained how to find the information and why you want it, the clerk will go off and get one of the other clerks to help him try to find Garcia, and then come back and tell you there is no such man. Of course, I may lose my bet, but according to the law of average, I will not. This incapacity for independent action, this moral stupidity, this infirmity of the will, this unwillingness to cheerfully catch hold and lift, these are the things that put pure socialism so far into the future. If men will not act for themselves, what will they do when the benefit of their effort is for all? My heart goes out to the man who does his work when the boss is away, as well as when he is at home. And the man who, when given a letter from Garcia, quietly takes the missive without asking any idiotic questions, and with no lurking intention of chucking it into the nearest sewer, but deliver it, never gets laid off, nor has to go on a strike for higher wages. Civilization is one long, anxious search for just such individuals. Anything such a man asks shall be granted. He is wanted in every city, town, and village, in every office, shop, store, and factory. The world cries out for such. He is needed and needed badly. The man who can carry a message to Garcia.